Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. We should start with Mel. Melvin Weinberg, that is. Henceforth, just Mel. Mel was one of the best con men who ever graced the nation. He did it in a wide variety of ways, making millions. Hard to know how much for sure, as he didn't exactly stay on this side of income reporting, by cooking up ingenious schemes, talking fast, and never forgetting a face or a favor. It meant that he knew a few mobsters and most of the East Coast schemers, all of whom he had treated well enough to stay alive. Prior to 1978, his most lucrative scam had been a front-end number where he had bogus certificates of deposits run through offshore banks to be collateral for real loans. I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. Just know for now that his CD operation had been elaborate and well thought out. These were Mel's strengths. Before he was cooking up certificates of deposit, though, Mel was cutting his teeth on the streets of the Bronx, where he grew up, the son of a man who ran a plate glass business. He served in the Navy during World War II, came home, and discovered he had a gift. It wasn't an honest one. Mel sold socks with no soles, jackets with no backs, whatever a guy could talk fast enough to move before the customer noticed something was missing. It was small time. It was also, if you squint, a kind of apprenticeship. By the time Mel graduated to certificates of deposit, he understood something most con men never bother learning. The mark wants to believe you. Your job is just to give him a reason. He excelled at that. Now, his weakness was women. He always had to have two, a wife and a mistress, both whom he tried to keep happy. All of this made him the perfect man for a job the Federal Bureau of Investigation had been trying to launch for years. Simply put, they knew how to handle wise guys and bank robbers. They were less skilled with shutting down the guys with pencils. In 1978, Mel was the king of homemade white-collar crime. So, when he got into a bit of trouble, Mel agreed to help them, provided his longtime girlfriend could skate free. Sure, he'd still be a convicted felon that way, but he'd be the best kind of convicted felon. That is, one who never saw the inside of a prison cell. Mel would be the reason the massive FBI operation worked as well as it did, because no one had more credibility with the people they were setting out to catch, as in other crooks who dealt in stolen art, fraudulent securities, and the other whatnot which gets filed under white-collar shenanigans. In the end, the net the FBI and Mel spread caught much bigger fish. That was an unexpected bonus that mesmerized this country in the early 1980s. The FBI did some fine work, but it was Mel who was the reason that on February 2nd, 1980, I'll just let NBC News anchor Tom Snyder tell you.
Some big names in politics got visits today from agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The FBI agents wrapping up the undercover phase of something called Operation Abscam. It's what one U.S. attorney calls the biggest political scandal in this country since Watergate.
Watergate had rocked the nation at the start of the 70s, and most Americans had already been disavowed of any belief that all politicians were working to better the nation. They knew that plenty were working far harder to better themselves. Still, the news shocked the nation for its sheer audacity on the part of the FBI and for its evidence of open-faced greed among some they had elected. The operation would eventually lead to the conviction of one U.S. senator, five members of the House of Representatives, the mayor of Camden, New Jersey, and a few lesser political lights. But it started with one FBI supervisor having faith in a man who lied for a living. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. Once the nights start getting a little cooler, there is nothing better than getting into a really comfortable bed at the end of the day.
It's true. This is the time of year where great sheets and a soft duvet make a real difference.
Which is exactly why Quince has become one of my go-tos. I've got several sets of their sheets now, and I love them because they're deep enough to actually fit our mattress properly. That sounds small, but it's such a common problem with other sheets.
They make hotel-quality bedding out of premium natural materials. Their European linen gets softer with every wash, and the organic cotton's breathable and soft for everyday comfort.
I use Quince, and you should too. And it's not just the sheets. Scott and I have pajamas from them now, and we love them.
Oh, I love my PJs. The best part is ours match, so we get to gross out our neighbors by being so adorable.
And it's not just bedding and pajamas either. I've picked up other clothing pieces from them too. They bring that same quality into apparel, home essentials, cookware, furniture, all of it.
Make your bed your favorite place to be this season with Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/centuries. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/centuries.
As explained in Robert W. Greene's The Sting Man, Inside Abscam, men like Mel Weinberg were always on the lookout for those who needed a lot of money but couldn't get funding from a legitimate bank. What Mel would do was pose, quote, as a businessman with links to banks that usually exist only on paper. The swindler, naturally, can produce the names of these banks and assures the desperate men that he has a successful record of getting loans from them for his clients, end quote. The bank was usually just a guy with a telex, an early form of fax, and a phone and some fancy letterhead. With a bit of fancy telex communication, the quote-unquote bank assured the needy guy that it would consider the loan request if it's properly processed. The processing fee, which could range up to $50,000 depending on the size of the loan, of course, had to be paid in advance. That fee was paid to the swindler, who then stalled a while before the loan was, sadly, not approved after all. But wait, take heart. The con man would have another idea for another fee. For the financially challenged, and hey, no judgment, I'm raising my hand here, CDs are legit, of course, but in this case, the swindler would inform our poor Mark that, for a percentage of the value of the CDs that the bank just rejected, the same bank would issue CDs that would provide him with certificates showing that he did have large sums on deposit. The Mark was told that he could use these certificates as security for loans from his own local banks. In other words, one so-called offshore bank would guarantee another legit bank that your guy had the money. Banks have insurance, by the way, should they get defrauded in this way, so nobody, in theory, suffers. Mel set up his company, London Investors, in a posh office in Melville, New York, a small hamlet on Long Island. He dressed the part with expensive tailoring. Sometimes he would use his girlfriend Evelyn, draped in jewels, as window dressing when they would meet, all to show the Mark that he was a worldly and successful high-end trader. Mel wheeled and dealed with this tidy scam for the best part of a decade. He did well for himself, working, he said, 100 people a month. Here he is in an exchange with Mike Wallace for an episode of 60 Minutes.
The company I had must average of $500,000 to $1 million a year or more.
This is London Investors?
That's correct.
And your deal basically was getting front money from people that you were going to deliver loans to, except you never delivered the loans.
That's correct.
Mel was not all bad. During that time, he gave a small tip to the FBI, for his own purposes, after another con artist asked him how to sell a stolen U.S. Treasury note. The FBI told him to play along. He did. The other guy got caught. Small doings. Mel continued his CD scams, uninterrupted by police interference, raking in cash from various corners. He had been too busy to notice that post-Watergate, a few of the rules of his game had changed. When an angry businessman did not like being ripped off, he went to the FBI, and that's when they called Mel to ask exactly what he had done to deserve these usurious fees. That jump-started an investigation into his little operation on Long Island. And in February 1977, Mel was indicted for wire fraud, mail fraud, and conspiracy. Soon enough, girlfriend Evelyn Knight also had an arrest warrant out on her, and Mel, being Mel, called his gangster friends. He had done a recent favor for mafioso royalty Meyer Lansky, who found her a nice, out-of-the-way apartment where she could hide. For what it's worth, she had had no idea she'd been doing anything wrong. As the spring of 1977 wore on, the feds were getting close to Evelyn, and by summer, Mel decided to deal. He gave up Evelyn. On October 7th, 1977, Mel pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Ever the dealer, he had arranged a plea agreement that would keep him out of jail and Evelyn out of court. He would help the feds if they dropped the charges against her. It was the best he could do for her. And it's hard to know whether wife Marie, who was as accommodating to Mel as Evelyn was, knew much. She had the big house, plenty of money, and could do as she pleased. It's an agreement they both understood. There's every indication that she loved Mel very much. She went along. Now, an FBI supervisor assigned to New York read an internal memorandum about Mel and knew instantly that he had the exact experience the Bureau needed in the world it now wished to enter. The supervisory agent had the improbable name of John Good. When he found out that Mel wanted to deal, he felt he'd won the lottery. The joint effort got off to a rocky start. Mel didn't like doing business any other way but his own. He and a few agents butted heads, as Mel deemed them too obvious and too straight. He had a reputation to maintain, after all. With his prior company, London Investors, back up and running with a newly imaged company he dubbed Swiss Bank Associates, he was hooking some big fish. Where it could, the government got indictments and got men tried for the things they were doing with Mel. Of course, they were careful, only doing this when they knew Mel would be insulated from the action and arrest and no one would be the wiser. His plea deal was for work on 4 cases. When those were done, Mel stayed on to do more. Mike Wallace again.
Mel Weinberg, why did you cooperate with the FBI? Help the FBI to stage Abscam? Was it fear? Was it patriotism? Or was it just another way to make a buck?
Strictly for the money. I went in and started with them.
The whole thing was tricky, but Mel was earning his keep. He may also have been pocketing some of the cash used in the operations, though there wasn't all that much lying around, something he complained about endlessly. He was also taping every conversation he had with the feds and every conversation he had with his marks. Likewise, the feds bugged and videotaped, in very poor black and white footage, the illegal goings-ons. As I said, Mel thought the Bureau was incredibly cheap. How exactly was he supposed to come off as a prosperous trader and high-end financier if he had no office and no expense money and was told to live off a salary of $1,000 a month? Adjusting for inflation, that's about $5,100 a month in today's money, which, by the way, was more than some agents made. Regardless, he knew he needed to produce some results. And Mel was no puppet. He was a thinker. He always offered useful suggestions for making the scheme smarter and more bulletproof. He even outwitted one guy who wanted a money transfer to be done without Mel knowing where the rendezvous point was. The Mark told Mel he wanted to fly a plane to an airport where his people were, but he wouldn't tell Mel the destination until they were airborne. That way, no advance efforts could be made to thwart the transfer. Mel agreed to the plan. The Mark got on the plane and told the pilot which airport to land at. The pilot, of course, was an FBI agent who radioed below to other agents and began circling the airport until the agents reached the quote-unquote unknown destination. Meanwhile, Mel distracted the Mark so he wouldn't catch on that they were dawdling. It worked beautifully. When the agents asked how he had come up with this plan, Mel told them he had seen it on TV. Ah, Mel. He might be a guy with glasses and thinning hair and a paunch, but he was Crime Stopper gold. According to writer Green, he was really enjoying the work. Green quoted Mel as saying, "It was sort of like the Super Bowl of scam. I was playing against the best, and I was winning." That's when he took another plan to John Good. This one grew out of something everyone in finance had suddenly noticed. Enormous amounts of Arab oil money were looking for a place to land with a guaranteed return attached. You might ask why it was news that Arab sheiks had money. Well, 5 years earlier, in 1973, OPEC, that's the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, had triggered an oil crisis in the United States when its members decided to severely limit oil exports to nations that had supported Israel in the 19-day Yom Kippur War that October. Because of decreased oil production at home, OPEC could set prices, which were now doubling and quadrupling to levels previously unseen in the United States. This shortage and this price level had led to long gas lines and to increased efforts to conserve usage.
Gas lines at many stations were a lot longer than normal.
Line today is longer than it's ever been.
I've been in two gas lines already.
This morning?
This morning.
How long did you wait for the first
one? I've been in both lines over an hour, and I'm out of gas.
What are we trying to do?
Well, my son is trying to see how much gas we have left in the tank and whether we can make it out on the Sawmill River Parkway. So he stuck his walkie-talkie antenna in the tank.
For those listeners who are younger, a lot of your elders remember that the pain was real. Most boomers can still remember exactly where they were when they first paid $1 for a gallon of gas. Don't laugh, I wasn't around yet, but I understand it was a grim time. Disco, 70s clothing, this. Just kidding, some disco is great. Anyway, Mel had noticed all the newsprint spent on the topic. And a few years back, he remembered how he had found himself sitting in a Pan American Airways first-class section next to a Beirut businessman. They got friendly, and Mel, who was a chatty and generous guy, helped his new friend shop in New York for some finery. By the time they landed, Mel had a sense of just how much money was moving out of the Gulf and how much some of the people holding it wanted a foothold in the West. He put the plan to John Good, and soon the London investors gig was reworked. Mel would now play American agent for a wealthy man of his own invention, Kambir Abdul Rahman, millionaire and kin to Arabian royalty. In fact, Mel suggested, let's make him an emir. Rahman didn't exist, but Mel made sure everyone thought he did. A busy man, impossible to reach most days, always shuttling between homes in Switzerland, Beirut, and Cannes. Mel built him into a guy who embraced the Western world and wanted to influence it in all the right ways. Which is to say, put money in all the right hands. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Timeline. For years, women were taught that exfoliation had to sting, burn, or leave your skin peeling to actually be doing something.
Which is wild, because that's not really how skin works, right?
Right. As skin changes, stronger isn't always smarter. That's what got me interested in Timeline's Exfoliator. It's a Swiss-born longevity company with over 18 years of cellular health research, and this leave-on treatment pairs salicylic, mandelic, and lactic acids with their MitoPure ingredient for surfacing plus cellular support.
So how's that actually been for you?
I really love it. My skin feels so smooth afterward, my pores look smaller to me, and my makeup goes on so much easier. For me, it's been really gentle, too. It's nothing like the stinging, stripped feeling I've had with other exfoliators.
It's formulated for all skin types, including sensitive skin, too.
In a 3-week user trial of women ages 47 to 65, 100% of participants agreed the exfoliation was effective yet gentle, and that tracks with my experience.
Timeline is offering a 15-day trial of the MitoPure Resurfacing Exfoliator for just $22. Give it 15 days and see how your skin looks and feels.
Go to timeline.com/COTC to try it for $22. Mel Weinberg's new venture went by the name of Abdul Enterprises LTD. It's from this business name the term Abscam was coined. At first, Abdul Enterprises got the word out that its benefactor wanted to buy art. People with access to stolen or forged works came out of the woodwork. The FBI had its own art authenticator on hand to help, and within a short while, the new Mel FBI partnership had recovered artwork worth more than $1 million. But that wasn't the half of it. The deals were netting some organized crime figures from New York and Philadelphia. One thing led to another, the way it does in a world where every con man knows every other con man, and all of them know where the real money is. And they could make deals too. The FBI soon had more on its hands than it knew what to do with. Colin Heaton, a former history professor, explains on his YouTube channel, Forgotten History.
Undercover agents posing as buyers quickly uncovered major fraud schemes, ultimately preventing the sale of nearly $600 million in bogus securities. Several arrests followed, and some of those taken into custody began to cooperate, revealing connections that reached into high-level politics.
By now, Abdul Enterprises had added a second fake sheik. He was given the name Yasser Habib, which, like Abdul, had been lifted by Mel from some previous con. Two FBI agents were recruited to don Arab robes and gutra, the plain white headdress held in place by a nagal, a black cord. The FBI got them from a costume shop. Realizing that the game was about to get bigger, John Good jumped through a lot of hoops to get the Bureau to deposit $1 million in a Chase Manhattan account and the number of a real Chase banker. This was necessary in case anyone wanted to check the sheik had an American bank account housing a significant amount of money. It would give the project the level of credibility Mel could have only imagined before. It also made the game a bit more dangerous. The whole operation ran into a bit of a snag in the midst of an offer from Edward Linick, an Ohio man who wanted to sell two banks to Mel. Mel and an FBI agent told Linick that the money he needed for the deal would come from Abdul's bank deposits in the Mideast. This was just the familiar seedy razzle-dazzle game. Then, one evening, an associate of Linick, a man named William Bell, met Mel and another agent at their hotel. Bell straight away asked if the sheik needed machine guns. Mel was quick on his feet and told Bell that Abdul needs lots of them. They had arranged to meet again, but later that night, Bell showed up at Mel's private room, shoved him down, and put a pistol fashioned with a silencer to his head. Mel figured this was it. He'd been found out. Bell pulled the trigger. A bullet went into the mattress Mel was lying on. Turned out, Bell was just demonstrating his product to his potential buyer. Later, when the arms deal was about to conclude, agents rushed in and, for show, roughed up Mel, who, for show, looked at Bell's representatives and told them he wanted the $17 million that he'd just handed over for the guns. He grumbled angrily that the weapons were now government property. Mel made sure that Bell and his people still believed that Abdul, the money, and the deal had truly been in play. Both men were arrested. When preliminary arguments in the case were made on December 4, 1978, in Greensboro, North Carolina, the defendants argued that their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights had been violated. The U.S. attorney then privately told the local judge that the government had an ongoing investigation into Abdul Enterprises, and would he please hold off on ruling on this case until that was concluded? The judge agreed. Greater good and all that. The Justice Department then explained the entire scope of the Abscam operation to a federal judge. Mel and his FBI friends had dodged more than just that one bullet. Things were moving fast. Every conversation now with those who wanted to help Abdul spend his money came with bits and pieces of new information. At any one time, the Abscam bunch could be working on a dozen fronts. Then, on May 26, 1978, Resorts International opened Atlantic City's first casino. It didn't take long for a black marketer to mention that some of Abdul's money could be used to help others enter that fray in an arena that the government already knew was riddled with corruption. The offhand comment was made by William Rosenberg, a small-time crook who came to Mel's office with a typed three-page list of potential deals for the firm. One was in Greece, another in Thailand, another in Indonesia. The ask was for many millions of dollars for each. Rosenberg, it seemed, had no doubt at all that Abdul's money was real or that there was enough of it to go around. The initial $2 million ask was for a used shipping crane to be bought by the city of Camden, New Jersey, which was in the process of trying to upgrade its port. The mayor of Camden was Angelo Arricchetti. Let's pause here for a moment to give a shout out to the 2013 movie American Hustle. The movie, which garnered 10 Academy Award nominations, winning none, was more or less based on what happened next. The part of Mel was played by Christian Bale. Bradley Cooper played an FBI agent. Jeremy Renner played Carmine Polito, a character based on Arricchetti. The movie opens with the disclaimer that some of this actually happened. It's not a documentary, though Mel did sell the rights for the story for a cool quarter mil. Because, of course he did. But back to Arricchetti. He was the first politician whose name came to the attention of the FBI. He was someone Mel understood. Here he is again with Mike Wallace.
When you met Arricchetti, what did you figure about him?
I liked him.
You liked Arricchetti?
Oh, yeah. I think if I had met Arricchetti, say, 5-6 years ago, we would make some partners. I mean, he was something else. He was terrific.
Why? What?
He would get into any crooked deal you want. He would bring up some real crazy deals to us. I mean, he wanted to get into counterfeit money. He wanted to give us the port of Camden for narcotics. Anything that was dishonest, he wanted to do. I mean, he was a likable guy. I mean, out of all the people that we dealt with, he was the most likable one now.
What makes him likable?
Well, you know where he was coming from. I mean, he wouldn't hedge. He wasn't a crier. He'd come out and tell you exactly what it was. I mean, he wouldn't beat around the bush. He'd tell you he wanted this. He wanted to make money.
As I said, it was just a mention about the mayor from this guy Rosenberg. Mel perked up. So did the FBI guys in the room. Could they meet the mayor, they asked, knowing full well he was the most powerful Democratic leader in the state. He was everything they could have hoped for. Obviously on the take, Arricchetti bragged how he could do everything from skimming off the top on costs of equipment to making sure that Abdul got a casino license in New Jersey. The first was easy, the feds knew. The second was nearly impossible. Funny aside, courtesy of Green's book, as relayed by an old friend of the pod, the history guy.
At one reception on the yacht, which was called the Left Hand, one of the faux sheikhs presented a tribal dagger to Arricchetti. Green explains, Arricchetti, his eyes glistening, promised his friendship and aid to the sheikh. Weinberg had purchased the dagger at an Athens flea market for $2.75.
Now, Eric Heddy had working class roots that made him, curiously, both greedy and generous. He'd need about $400,000 to pass through him to grease the palms of everyone along the way. In Atlantic City, prospective casino owners had to be approved twice to be allowed to own a casino. Further, the building they planned to use as the casino had to already be built and ready to go before any approval, or for that matter, rejection, was made known. Eric Heddy then introduced the AppScam investigators to Philadelphia lawyer Howard Criden, who led them to other politicians who might want some, let's just say, opportunities. From Green's book again, quote, "Over the next year, the mayor offered or gave AbScam agents hot diamonds, guns and munitions, forged CDs, counterfeit money, stolen paintings, leasing contracts, municipal garbage contracts, unregistered boat for dope running, use of Port Camden as a narcotics depot, Atlantic City zoning changes, a list of 13 bribable state and city officials, the vice chairman of the State Casino Control Commission, the chairman of the New Jersey State Democratic Committee, and, directly or indirectly, five United States congressmen and a senator," end quote. Oh, and for good measure, Bob Guccione, the publisher of Penthouse, the girly magazine that was a tad raunchier than Playboy, needed some cash. He wanted a casino, too. Crimes of Centuries is sponsored by Wild Grain. We haven't told you about Wild Grain in a bit. I'm so glad they're back. We love Wild Grain.
Wild Grain delivers sourdough bread, seasonal pastries, and French butter made by small independent bakeries right to your door. Everything bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less with simple, recognizable ingredients you can actually pronounce.
Which matters to me. I can have warm, bakery-quality stuff whenever I want without worrying about it going stale in the pantry.
You can customize the box, classic, gluten-free, vegan, or protein, and they have flexible subscriptions so you can skip or cancel anytime.
Okay, I have to talk about the apple cider donuts because they're one of my favorite things we've had from a sponsor box, period. Fall seasonal item, and they did not miss.
She's not exaggerating. I watched her defend the last one with her life.
They're so good. Wild Grain is just amazing all around. Compared to grocery store bread, it's just a different category.
If you're looking for an easy way to enjoy bakery quality food at home, I definitely recommend giving Wild Grain a try.
The fan favorite apple cider donuts and other fall seasonal products are back for a limited time, so make sure you order before they sell out.
Visit wildgrain.com/COTC to get $30 off your first box plus free croissants for life.
Again, that's wildgrain.com/COTC for $30 off your first box and free croissants for life, or use promo code COTC at checkout. In February 1979, FBI Special Agent Anthony Amoroso Jr. entered the game. His job from now on was to play the part of Tony DeVito, Abdul's personal construction engineer. Amoroso had already worked on some very high-level cases in Florida and would help coordinate the action with AppScam in that state as well. He met Mel and told him that the Bureau was becoming the project's biggest fan. Before anyone could have hoped, Eric Heddy arranged for the men from Abdul Enterprises to meet attorney Alexander Feinberg, a close associate of the senior U.S. Senator from New Jersey, Democrat Harrison Williams. When they did, Feinberg explained that the government was in fresh need of titanium for use in military aircraft and aerospace purposes, and as it happened, Senator Williams and New Jersey garbage contractor George Katz knew of an available titanium mine in Virginia. They suggested Abdul could help clear the mine of debt and build a new processing plant nearby for great advantage to all. The feds knew that Williams had an equal share of that mine, but interestingly, had paid nothing into the venture. What was he doing instead for equal return on investment there? They didn't have to look hard to find out. Williams was chair of the Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources, a key player in overseeing how certain government contracts were structured and approved. If he had pushed any legislation that affected the mine, he'd be committing a federal crime. But again, the feds wondered, was his share in the business the price for shepherding the legislation through at the highest levels? If so, the problem was going to be how to prove it. As usual, Mel and Good hatched a plan. Abdul Enterprises would say they were in for a $100 million loan, but they wanted to also own shares in the titanium venture. That way, they could issue corporation stock to Williams and, per Green, who was quoting Mel, quote, ask him what he's going to do for us with the government. He'll have to tell us why he deserves a free ride, end quote. When Arachetti explained the deal to Williams, FBI agents were present with hidden cameras rolling. On that day, Williams told the undercover investigators that he believed in the project and, with great pleasure, he would talk up the project to President Jimmy Carter, Vice President Walter Mondale, and the Secretaries of State and Defense. He also suggested his lawyer front for him, hold the stock under his own name so nothing would trace back to Williams. Well, the FBI higher-ups got nervous. They wanted the shares handed over in person to the senator. So, on July 11th, 1979, Mel, Agent Amoroso, and Mayor Arachetti met Williams so that he could be surreptitiously videotaped receiving $13 million in unsigned shares in the newly formed mining corporation. The only condition was that Williams had to keep his 18% share because they wanted to assure his future help in other ventures. It looked good, but the U.S. attorney wanted it even more locked down if he was going to indict a sitting U.S. senator. So on January 15th, 1980, everybody in the mining deal reconvened. The agent, who was posing as Yasser Habib, told Williams the cash for the loan was in hand in the U.S. Habib then asked if the senator might arrange for him to be granted American citizenship or some other form of permanent status. And things were getting messy in the Middle East. You never know when you might have to pull up stakes. Senator Williams balked. No, he couldn't do that. But, rest assured, he would personally handle all the details in getting the legislation needed to get that mine contract. His goose was now as good as cooked. But other geese were already being plucked, as Mel and the FBI boys hadn't exactly been shirking. Arachetti and his pal, Philadelphia attorney Howard Criden, had served up a few others, including a handful of congressmen who might be easily tempted. The busy got busier. The bugs were running in hotel rooms in Florida, Nevada, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., wherever the next mark wanted to talk. Public servants of every stripe were taking meetings and money from a crowd of swindlers and con men who had heard about Abdul's reputation. More money flowed into the sting, but the FBI was growing increasingly nervous because world affairs had made some officials leery of doing business with Middle Eastern money. The Iranian Revolution had just culminated in early 1979 with the ousting of the last monarchical Shah of Iran. In his place, the revolutionaries put Ayatollah Khomeini, an Islamic cleric, in charge. America had become the great villain in those parts. So much so that, on November 4, 1979, 66 Americans were taken hostage at the American Embassy in Tehran. Six escaped to the Canadian Embassy, where they were hidden. Most of the 66 had been diplomats. Others were civilian personnel who worked for the embassy staff. Within weeks, 13 were released. A few were smuggled out. For more on this, see the Oscar-winning 2012 movie Argo. The rest of the hostages were released on January 20th, 1981, when the U.S. made a deal to unfreeze $8 billion in Iranian assets. They'd been held 444 days. But the scam plugged on, moving faster now as they knew nothing was secret for long in Washington and they needed to start making arrests. It was in the summer of 1979 that the first congressman, U.S. Representative Michael Ozzie Myers, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, was approached. It was far too simple. The meeting took place in a hotel room near JFK Airport. The agents and Mel offered Myers $50,000 in an explicit exchange for Myers to arrange an approval of the personal residency for Habib. That would require the introduction of a residency bill that would have to meet with Congress's approval. Myers bragged he knew lots of well-placed others who would help if he asked, saying that, quote, money talks in this business and bullshit walks, end quote. He took the suitcase full of taxpayer cash and left. Then came a repeat performance of that with another Pennsylvania Democrat, Raymond Lederer, in the same hotel. All of it was on tape. Most started like this excerpt from inside a hotel room where the FBI was waiting for Rep. John Murtha, also a Democrat from Pennsylvania. Do note that Murtha was not convicted of any crime, but was named an unindicted co-conspirator who later testified for the government.
This is Special Agent Anthony Amoroso Jr., Federal Bureau of Investigation. Today's date is January 7th, 1980. Location, a townhouse in Washington, D.C. In a short while, I'm expecting a meeting between myself, Mel Weinberg, Howard Criden, and U.S. Congressman John Murtha. In front of me is $50,000 in five packets.
To be fair to Murtha, I'll include this part where he declines the bribe.
I'm not interested.
Okay.
At this point.
Okay.
You know, we do business for a while. Maybe I'll be interested, maybe I won't.
No. Okay.
So close. If he'd only stopped at no. Anyway, at some point, most meetings were moved from hotels to a rented Georgetown townhouse. It was quite a spread, as reported by NBC News at the time.
This townhouse was the scene of lavish parties thrown by undercover FBI agents who were posing as businessmen with Arab money backing. In the basement, behind a well-stocked wine rack, was the equivalent of a network TV control room. There was a chauffeur for the limousine, a butler and a maid, all undercover FBI agents.
CBS Justice Department reporter Fred Graham talked to townhouse owner Lee Lascaz after the news of arrests in the case broke.
The owner of the townhouse happened to be a newspaper reporter, Lee Lascaz of the Washington Post, who was out of the city on assignment. He sheepish that he didn't get onto the story because his neighbors were suspicious.
They would say, boy, you know what's going on in your house? It's strange. It's not like normal folks. A lot of businessmen come there every day carrying briefcases, wearing business suits. They come in cars with New Jersey, New York, and other license plates out of the immediate area. And they seem to hold meetings, all of the meetings, down in the basement. And then,
to be clear, many of the politicians approached turned down the overtures to sell their influence. They weren't all corruptible. Still, half dozen congressmen took the bait. The FBI knew that the party was about to be over. The New York Times and Washington Post were investigating, as were Newsday and NBC. On February 2nd, 1980, on the day that the news was set to break, the FBI began making arrests. Those targeted denied any wrongdoing. Here's Williams, Jenrette, Murphy, and Kelly in order.
I have done nothing wrong, and that's as much as I think is necessary to say now.
I know of no wrongdoing that I have done or the congressional office that I serve in.
I didn't take any actions on behalf of anyone. I merely met with some people who portrayed themselves in a certain light.
I have not been involved in any kind of criminal activity.
Yet, there they were that same day, a half dozen elected representatives of the American people shown on TV carrying suitcases of money out of hotels, their bags stuffed with more than most Americans made for a whole year of hard work. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. Can we talk about how hard it is to find a therapist who actually takes your insurance? Every time I've looked, half of them don't take insurance at all, and you're stuck paying full price or some expensive subscription.
Right, and it's wild because you never think twice about using insurance for a regular doctor's visit. Why should mental health be any different?
That's what got me curious about Rula. I looked into their therapist myself, and I was impressed with how quickly they helped me find someone who seemed like a real fit, based on what I was actually looking for, not just whoever happened to be available.
That's kind of their whole thing. Rula's a healthcare company. They partner with over 1 100 insurance plans, and the average copay ends up being around $15 a session.
And it's not just whoever's next. They take your goals and preferences into account so you end up with a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who actually line up with what you need.
No wait lists either. Appointments as soon as tomorrow, and they stay with you through it, checking in as you go.
Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit Rula.com/COTC to get started.
Again, that's Rula, RULA.com/COTC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
A few days after the app scam news broke, Americans heard something that may have heartened them a little. It was Senator Larry Pressler of South Dakota, seated in the basement of his Georgetown home, talking to those he was told were representatives of the Middle East interests.
50,000 is no problem.
It would not be proper for me to promise to do anything in return for campaign contributions.
The venerable Walter Cronkite, who by that time had weathered world wars, Watergate, and a presidential assassination, reported on February 4th, 1980, that Pressler was embarrassed to be called a hero.
Listen to the words of South Dakota Republican Senator Larry Pressler, commenting on the attention he's getting because he avoided the tentacles of an undercover FBI sting operation called ABSCAM, that's short for Arab Scam. Said Senator Pressler, "I turned down an illegal contribution. Whatever have we come to if that's considered heroic?"
Here's Robert Shackney of CBS News talking to Pressler.
Senator Pressler says he thought he was just meeting some potential campaign contributors, but that the two disguised FBI agents he thought were businessmen first had a request to make.
And they said they had friends in the Arab world who, if there was a revolution, they might want to come to the United States. And did I know how they could be assured to get into the United States? And then they mentioned, and there's some kind of bills that senators can introduce to get people in, and indeed there are private bills. At that point, I began to become suspicious, and I said, well, you know, there's a fellow who's in jail for doing that, and I don't know what you're suggesting, but so then the conversation continued, and pretty soon they said, well, how's your campaign coming? So we talked about my campaign just a little bit. They said, well, you know, a lot of money could be raised very quickly for that campaign. At that point, I stood up and said that, we may misunderstand each other. The direction you're heading would be very illegal, and I used the term illegal three times because I wanted to emphasize it to them. I took them to be very naive, flaky people who wanted to participate in the political process and didn't quite know how.
Meanwhile, some of those caught red-handed tried to explain themselves. One claimed he had only taken the money because he was conducting his own investigation into bribery. Another argued it was only fair to take OPEC's money and put it back in American pockets. All would make the legal argument that they had been entrapped. That is, they were induced into committing a crime that they were otherwise unwilling to commit. After the indictments were handed down and the federal trials began, the question of entrapment got a serious airing in the American media. On August 24, 1980, in an opinion piece written by Charles Babcock for the Washington Post, the paper asked, quote, how far the government can or should go in dangling bait in front of public officials, end quote. It also asked if the government had overreached in these cases and whether the accused were deprived of their constitutionally guaranteed right to due process. The opinion piece pointedly asked why the government had employed Mel to help. He was, after all, a convicted felon, untrained in the law, and a man who, gasp, misspelled Zurich on the business card he had used as a swindler during his London investors' days. Mel's response was terse and not directed at the Post, but to all of those who asked about entrapment. He saw it this way, he told Mike Wallace.
If he was an honest congressman, what the man should have done, because we mentioned money to him, was got up, walked out, and turned us in. He didn't get up and walk out. He stood there and listened to the rest of the spiel.
Which meant he was dishonest to start with. The ABSCAM operation resulted in juries convicting one U.S. senator, six members of the House of Representatives, Mayor Eric Hetty, three Philadelphia city councilmen, an official of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the precursor to ICE, and a small army of businessmen and lawyers. The argument about entrapment raged, especially when the convictions were appealed, and attorneys representing the defendants reminded the court that during the actual sting, lawyers were placed in adjoining hotel rooms to listen and would call the investigators when something was going off track and then tell them how to inveigle the congressman into agreeing to doing something illegal. But the conviction stuck, even on appeal, perhaps suggesting that while Abscab had teetered near the edge of the law and entrapment, it hadn't crossed it, at least not in the opinions of the American courts. In 1981, the U.S. Attorney General issued guidelines that stipulated more strict oversight and approval for the government's undercover work, especially if it concerned public officials. In subsequent years, as the nation faced terrorism at home, those guidelines would flex again. No matter. Congressman Myers and Lederer were both convicted of bribery and conspiracy. Myers served about a year and a half in federal prison. Lederer served 10 months. Myers became the first member of Congress since 1861 to be expelled from the House for corruption. By the way, if his name sounds familiar, that's because in 2020, he was indicted in a separate case, bribing Philadelphia election officials to stuff ballot boxes for local judicial candidates across 5 election cycles. He pleaded guilty in 2022 and was sentenced again, this time to 2.5 years. But back to Abscam. Congressman Frank Thompson was convicted and served 2 years in prison and paid a $50,000 fine. Congressman John Murphy of New York, who famously said he had no apologies to make to anyone, served about 18 months. Congressman Richard Kelly, Republican from Florida, served 13 months. Senator Harrison Williams was found guilty on 9 counts of bribery and conspiracy and promising to use his office to further a business in which he had a vested interest. Having served for 23 years in the Senate, he resigned his seat before the vote was taken to expel him. He served 2 years in prison. When Bill Clinton was in office, Williams appealed to him for a presidential pardon. Clinton declined to do so. Mayor Angelo Arricchetti got the heftiest sentence of all, 6 years. He ultimately served just shy of 3. And then there was Congressman John Jenrette, a Democratic congressman from South Carolina. He served 13 months in prison. But he and wife Rita held the gaze of the public the longest, mostly because in 1981, Rita wrote a tell-all book called My Capital Secrets. In it, she told of her husband's frequent infidelities and how she, his second wife, a comely blonde Texan who was a Democratic fundraiser, had sex with him on the U.S. Capitol steps during a brief recess. The D.C.-based comedy troupe Capitol Steps took their name from their escapade. If you know, you know. Anyway, Rita divorced her now sullied husband in 1981, but she could not seem to adjust to life outside of the spotlight, deciding to capitalize on her recent fame by posing nude in the April 1981 issue of Playboy and again in 1984. She also landed a role in a low-budget film called Zombie Island Massacre. In researching what the heck happened to her after that, I kept falling down rabbit holes, and let's just say it involved a prince, a 16th century Roman palazzo with a ceiling painted by Caravaggio, a court-ordered auction with a 9-figure price tag that never once attracted a buyer, a police eviction, a broken rib sustained fleeing out the back, and, as of a couple of years ago, reports that she's essentially couch surfing on very well-appointed couches. Her ex-husband, the disgraced South Carolinian, did okay for himself, eventually becoming a developer who retired to oceanfront property in Myrtle Beach. He died in 2023. All other principals in the Abscam story have died during the interim. One of the earliest deaths was that of Marie Weinberg, Mel's wife. It's not as entertaining a story as Rita's. Here's reporter Bethany Gregory reporting for ABC News from January 29th, 1982.
Weinberg's body was carried out of a neighbor's apartment as police ruled her death an apparent suicide. She'd been missing since Tuesday, but it wasn't until Thursday afternoon that this neighbor discovered her body in an adjacent apartment to which she had a key.
There was her body hanging from a rope in the middle of the stairwell. And then over on the table was a a note. It seemed to be addressed to her loved one, her son, J.R. Some looked like insurance or credit cards, and one rose.
Last week on ABC's 2020, Marie Weinberg charged that her husband, Mel, star witness during the Abscam trials, solicited gifts from targets of the investigation, picked up an attaché case which may have contained $45,000 in cash, and she charged that Weinberg bought off the FBI with gifts of household items.
Marie left a sworn affidavit behind that alleged Mel had lied on the stand and the FBI knew it. She said she was being threatened by her husband to stay quiet. Her accusations did not lead to any formal prosecution. Neither did they undermine his work on the Abscam case. Done dodging bullets, Mel married Evelyn Knight later that year. They made it 16 years before they divorced. Mel died in 2018. Evelyn didn't. She's alive as of this recording in her early 80s, and after decades spent playing a fictional Lady Evelyn for Mel's cons, she spent the years since choosing to be a nobody in particular. As far as I can tell, she's never once talked to the press about any of this. Good for her. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read The Sting Man, Inside Abscam by Robert W. Green. She also read Politico magazine's Mel Weinberg, The Con Man Who Flipped by Louise Maitland. And she read assorted archival stories in The Washington Post and New York Times, as well as work in the University of Virginia Law Special Collections. She accessed the history files offered by the FBI. She did not watch Zombie Island Massacre, which is apparently available on Tubi. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.